Accession number 12551, Reel 2.
Colonel Wooldridge, Reel 2.
I arrived in Korea virtually as the war ended, which was quite an interesting time to be there, because at that time the demilitarized zone was not demilitarized. So having arrived at Busan and gone up country to the 38th parallel, we found that we were able to be taken, and were taken, by those who'd seen combat over their positions. And I particularly remember going over the Hook, where the Duke of Wellington's regiment had had a terrific battle with the Chinese, and being talked round it by the company commander who was there at the time, which was fascinating. We then, in fact, were living just a bit back from what was called the Kansas Line, in tents, and we used to spend all our time, most of our time, preparing the Kansas Line, which at that time was only scrapes. In fact, it wasn't even scrapes, it was just being sighted as a defensive line to the south of the demilitarized zone. We prepared it and dug bunkers and holes for bunkers and got concrete lintels and learned how to build these things. And that was a very interesting time too, because I was given a hill with my platoon, which, although I'd been the anti-tank platoon commander right through Austria, they didn't have any anti-tank guns in Korea, so I became the Browning machine gun platoon commander. And we had Browning machine guns borrowed from the Americans, and we all learned how to use those. I was given a little feature, a little knoll between two higher hills, and told, sight your platoon on there, facing that way, which I did, in the approved fashion, lying down on the ground and looking at the fields of fire and all that sort of thing. And then said I'd done it, and the company commander said, well, yes, I'd better have a look. So he came and he laid down and he moved one or two or three inches one way or the other. Then a commanding officer came along and he said, well, yes, he thought he'd like to have a lie down too. He's presumably doing this in every company position that was. And I thought, well, at last we can start digging. But the CO said, no, we'll just have the brigadier round. So the brigadier came then. And it's scarcely credible. We did start digging after the brigadier had been and said, well, this is more or less okay. But the final straw was when, I think it must have been General Hull. I think he was the CNC of the UN forces there. Anyway, certainly somebody with red tabs, and in those days I wasn't too aware of which red tab meant what. He came and he lay down on the ground, and we were required, by this time we'd dug a big hole, we were required to move it 2 feet to the right, which we did. We had in that time attached to us Korean attached Commonwealth services, CATCOMs they were called, and my platoon, and mine was an independent, a support platoon, so I was independent really, which was very nice. My platoon, I had 10 CATCOMs, including Choi Duk Ho, who was a very cheerful chap. And as we dug some of these holes, one of my soldiers dug up a skull, which he held up by the hair that was still on it, shook it, and all the brains started to fall out, at which all the CATCOMs turned white and fled the position. And we had, in fact, to carry out a religious ceremony and bury again this skull somewhere away from where we were digging the holes, and put him to rest. But we carried on doing all this. Periodically, we would have strenuous exercises, marching for miles up and down all those Korean hills, which at times were covered in azaleas, and very beautiful. I've never been as fit as I was in Korea, going up and down those hills, and I was fairly young then too. The air was so cool and clear, it was lovely. In freezing cold in the winter, and very hot and wet in July time. Great extremes. We got on very well with the Australians who were in our brigade, and the Kiwis who were gunners in our brigade. We saw a lot of the Americans, It was a very happy time. We were there for a year only. And of course, as I say, there was no war. So although we were training hard for any war that came, we did have a purpose, or I thought we did, and we set out to achieve it. I forgot to say that we also walked over all the Gloucester Hill position and had that all explained to us, that brave action by the poor old Gloucesters. That too was very interesting. What else about Korea? I didn't like the town, Seoul and Busan are dreadful.
What was wrong with the towns?
They were sleazy, really. Not surprisingly, not their fault. Where they were up to date, they were Americanized in an unpleasant way. I'm not anti-American at all, but they'd got some of the worst things of the Americans rather than some of the best things. Everybody got 7 days leave in Tokyo, which was supposed to be called R&R, rest and rehabilitation, but as you probably know, it's called I&I, intoxication and intercourse. I didn't actually either get intoxicated or have intercourse, but it was an experience to go for 7 days to Tokyo and have a bath, for one thing. Marvellous. Had two baths a day. And, of course, some marvellous restaurants, everything very cheap compared, in those days, compared with everything else. And that was an extremely interesting experience.
So you preferred the Japanese towns to the Korean?
Certainly. I only saw Tokyo. I didn't see any other Japanese towns. But that too, although Americanized, was very pleasant. I mean, you could get jolly good food, you could go to good shows. As I say, you could have two baths a day. That was the main thing. It was a very good leave hotel where you stayed. that was an experience. Oh yes, the worst part of that experience was flying there in, not a C-130, because they weren't built in. I can't remember what the plane was called. A very large aeroplane filled with drunken Canadian Vandoos.
Vandoos?
22nd Regiment of Canada, who also served in the Commonwealth Division. Good regiment they were, but they did like their booze a bit. And I don't like being in an aeroplane with a lot of drunk Canadians, most of them with beards. But that was an interesting experience as well.
Were you able to make any friends with the Koreans?
Only the CATCOMs, and they were very likable. I've never forgotten, whenever they went off on leave, they had to be lined up, given various bits of paper and documents, and took one look at them. I couldn't believe our eyes, they were bulging, so we searched them. And they'd stuffed into all their clothes, rations and spare socks and all sorts of things to take to their relations. You couldn't really blame them, I expect they were very deprived. But they weren't allowed to take them all anyway. They were allowed to take a certain amount in reason. But they were very good-humoured, most of them, and they must have been through a dreadful time. I would never wish, other than the Azaleas, I wouldn't want to ever go back to Korea. Didn't appeal to me as a country. Very hard country physically as well. Just one ridge after another. As soon as you climb one mountain, there was another one in front of you after you'd gone down first. Not to a colossal height, but high enough to get you pretty winded.
Did you have any feelings about the enemy in Korea?
I don't think I liked the Chinese from what I'd heard about them. I didn't like the North Koreans, but it's quite illogical not to like the North Koreans and to like the South Koreans. So I suppose it was, again, reputation rather than personal knowledge.
What was the Chinese reputation?
Mass attacks, disregard of human life, just plough on, achieve what you're setting out to achieve no matter what cost. Ruthlessness.
Did you ever see anything of the enemy soldiers?
No. Well, I suppose I looked through binoculars and saw some, perhaps a few, but not really, no. In fact, there was far more animosity between the Australians and the New Zealanders, who used to pass each other with One lot were walking along and marching along the road, and the other lot went past in the truck. They made sure they emptied their water bottles over the other side as they went past. But I have a great regard for both. They're good soldiers and they're good men.
Sounds as though you were in Korea from 53 to 54.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And then three of us, then the battalion were going to the canal zone, and three of us applied to go to the parachute regiment.
Why did you do that?
Well, mainly because one of our number at Sandhurst had been in a thing called the Teddy Bear Club, and he kept saying how marvellous the parachute regiment was.
The Teddy Bear Club?
Yes.
What was that?
Well, cadets at Sandhurst, I think it still exists probably, it certainly did for many years, could do a brief parachute course, jump out of an aeroplane, and the mascot of the course was called Edward Bear. And he was a teddy bear who went down on his own little parachute. And if you did the course, you got the parachute on your sleeve, but you didn't get the parachute wings, the airborne forces wings, because you obviously hadn't served in the airborne forces. So this guy was a member of the Teddy Bear Club, and he told us how marvellous the parachute regiment were, as anyone who's ever been in it bores everybody stiff doing so. And for some reason, persuaded us to have a go. So we three of us applied, and three of us were accepted. And we went to the dreaded P Company in Aldershot to do this awful training selection course.
What was the dreaded P Company?
Well, there's recently been a television programme about it showing the most awful things that you go through. I can remember the three of us who lived in the officer's mess in Aldershot. Made a barracks, I think it must have been. Shared a room, and we literally helped each other out of bed in the mornings because we were so stiff and unable to move. It was designed to push you over the limit, if possible, to see if you could keep going. And it included the dreaded log race, which meant carrying a large log, about six or eight of you, racing against other people. The art of that was to prove that you were actually carrying your share of the log. And if you were appearing to carry it without actually doing so, you would be detected immediately. You went runs in all directions, jogging. I, in fact, have always enjoyed athletics, so it didn't worry me so much. But you'd carry weights, long distances. You had the dreaded milling, where everybody in turn went into the ring for 1 minute to hit the other chap with everything he'd got. It wasn't boxing, it was just flog away and see who can keep it up best, and one would be declared the winner and one would be declared the loser. There was nothing significant about it, except it was bloody stupid, really. But they seemed to select the right sort of people. Not many people fell out. And after you've done, I think it must have been 4 weeks, was it 4 weeks? Maybe less. At P Company, you then went on to Abingdon to learn how to jump out of these balloons and aeroplanes and things. And the failure rate there was very small indeed, which I suppose pointed up the benefit of the tough regime in P Company. Because it did weed out people earlier on, before they'd wasted a lot of people's time. Oh yeah, having got to Abingdon, we went through the usual floor exercises on learning how to roll when you land. We jumped off towers in harnesses. We jumped off the dreaded thing called the fan, where you were miles up in the roof of a hangar, and with a bit of rope wound round a camshaft thing with a fan on the end, and you were invited to jump off. And the fan slowed you down. You didn't believe this the first time, but it did. And you practiced all these horrors until you were unloosed in a barrage balloon. And that's the most dreadful experience you'll ever have, I should think. Because up you go and it gets very quiet. About five or six of you in the balloon. And you get up to the top and it stops 800 feet or so. And the wind whistles a bit, and it's as quiet as can be, and it's cold-blooded. And the PGI says, stand in the door, and the first one does, and I did. And he said, go, and I leapt out as instructed. Immediately I'd leapt out, his idea of a joke was to shout, come back! Which was beyond my powers at that time. My heart, my stomach, anyway, it was coming up into my mouth. Anyway, the parachute opened and down I floated, and that was a lovely feeling when that opened. And I think the balloon jumps were the worst, really, because when you're in an aeroplane later on, you've got all the noise and the bustle and more people and talking and shouting and yelling and lights coming on and whatnot. And it was less cold-blooded, but the first balloon jump was quite an experience.
What does PGI stand for?
Parachute Jumping Instructor, and they were all RAF chaps, and mine was a guy I've never forgotten called Sergeant Flint, who was a very good RAF boxer. I'd never heard what happened to him, but he was a jolly good chap.
Did you ever have any second thoughts about what you'd let yourself in for?
Not at this stage. And obviously my regiment did get as far as Abingdon. And then, in my view, he had the guts to say he didn't like jumping out of aeroplanes and he wanted to stop, so they took him off the parachute course, having done P Company, which is far worse than the parachute course. But I never wanted to stop parachuting at any stage because I was frightened of the parachuting, although I was frightened of it. I mean, before a jump, your stomach, we felt a bit sick always, or I did anyway. And I think most people did, probably. The exhilaration, and once you were out swinging there, and when you got down, you felt emperor of the world, I think Monty said. it's a terrific feeling. Later on, after I'd been in the parachute regiment 2 or 3 years, and we'd been messed around, I was married, and I was continually sent off to funny places, I did think, well, perhaps a more settled existence might be nicer, but I certainly didn't want to leave the parachute regiment because of the parachuting. So there we were. Anyway, I passed out of Abingdon, thank goodness, and was posted to the 3rd Battalion, the Parachute Regiment. And the guy who was the commanding officer had done the same parachute course as I had done. Paul Crook, great guy, finished a brigadier, got a DSO at Portside. A good man. He liked jazz, thought he could sing it. Frankie and Johnny used to sing with his eyes shut. I've heard worse. Anyway, went to Aldershot, to 3 Para, did a dreadful introduction where I and my platoon were dropped on Bodmin Moor and required to march, I can't remember, it was 40 miles in one night or 20 miles in each of 2 nights, but I know I'd got raw and bleeding feet at the end of it. And I thought, oh gosh, this is dreadful. Back to Aldershot. I'd become the mortar platoon commander now, so I did another course. Having been to Netheravon and done the anti-tank course, I became the mortar officer of 3 Para. And that's a jolly good job to have. Super, because you're in the CO's pocket if you're doing exercises or action or anything. And you've got your own fairly hand-picked platoon, really. And so, I became a mortar officer. We stayed at Aldershot for a time, came into work one morning and were told we're going to Cyprus in 2 days' time. So we told our wives, which cheered them up no end. And off we flew to Cyprus. In fact, because of trouble in Jordan, we went to Cyprus in 56. Wrong, 56 it must have been. We went to Cyprus because of trouble in Jordan. That's what we were standing by for. However, when we got to Cyprus, we spent our time chasing Grievous and his gangsters. We lived in Nicosia. We swooped all over the place. We cordoned and searched Nicosia. My main experience in that was leaping from one roof onto another, and sadly it was only asbestos sheeting, and I went straight through the roof into some poor Cypriot's kitchen where they were sitting around eating their breakfast amidst a shower of asbestos shards. And after they'd recovered from their surprise, I found I wasn't too bruised. We carried on. We cordoned off Nicosia. There were no motor vehicles allowed, so we commandeered every bicycle we could see, and we did all our patrolling and swooping around on bicycles, which I discovered at that time are a marvellous method of movement at night or in daytime, come to that, in an urban area, because it's so quiet and it's quicker than feet. And goodness knows how they sorted out all the hundreds of bicycles that were piled up in Ataturk Square when we'd finished the cordon and search, but that was their problem in those days. And then we'd rush off to Trudos Hills, where intelligence always said, well, now you're going to, we know exactly where these chaps are, you've surrounded the area, all you've got to do is find them. And 9 times out of 10 intelligence hadn't got the first idea where the perishers were. They knew where they'd been. As we kept finding bits, I found one of Grievous' own camps myself. We knew it was his because all the gear we carried back, which we were instructed to hand in to the intelligence organisation, identified him. We even got his perfume that he used. And I pinched his radio. I wasn't going to hand in that stuff because we knew half of the stuff once the intelligence had finished with it, they kept. So we thought we'd keep it first. So I had Grievous' radio. My Batman had his bed. And my little man called Mooney, who was a Scotsman, about 5 feet high. Great difficulty in keeping up with me as we strode over the hills. And then in between, we'd dash off to Morfu Bay or Kyrenia and have a day swimming. I mean, it was a glorious existence, really.
Was there any danger to you?
There might have been, I suppose, if we'd run into... The main danger was from our own side, I think, there. Because whenever you do internal security, more people get killed from accidental discharge of weapons than anything else. But we had certainly two nasty incidents. The least serious, and my most dangerous personally, was when we were cordoning an area in which Grievous was alleged to be, and the Royal Norfolk Regiment were also involved, and either one of us had been misdirected, or we'd misread our maps, and they were on one road up a hill, and we were 800 or 900 feet down below on another road. And they heard us moving in the dark and thought we were the other side, so they loosed off a few rounds. It went through the cook's tent. I've never seen cooks move so quickly. We managed to stop that. That didn't end in tragedy. Sadly, I sat on a board of inquiry where a one para patrol had been shot by a three para ambush party, and one man was killed. It would seem to me, and when I was on the inquiry, that it was faulty briefing by the one para commander, in that he hadn't briefed his men where to go and they went the wrong way. But then I'm biased because I'm three para, so perhaps that's not a fair judgment. But we spent some time in Cyprus. We were then suddenly rushed back to England.
Excuse me.
Sorry. Yes.
If I could ask about Cyprus, if you had any successes whilst you were there.
Oh, yes. We found a lot of weapons. We also, one ambush actually did ambush somebody and get them the model ambush. Halter eye fire with the muzzle of the guy's rifle within about 4 inches of the chap's ear. So he halted, so nobody fired, everybody was captured, and that was just exactly what we wanted. And we got information.
Where was that?
That was in Trudos. Cambos, can't remember the name. If I'd got a map, I perhaps could. But a village, we were surrounding a village to stop people going in and out, and we caught someone red-handed with weapons. Most of the time, like most war, I suppose, or most action, is inaction. And the hardest thing of all, in my experience, is lying at night in an ambush, not being able to move, but having to stay awake. And it's very, very difficult to do it for a long time. But we had successes. We never caught Grievous, sadly. And it was interesting.
Could you tell what the general attitude of the Greek Cypriot population was towards you?
I don't think they liked us. I don't think I'd like anyone who cordoned and searched my home at frequent intervals looking for weapons. I wasn't aware at that time of the colossal animosity between the Turks and the Greeks, I must say. To me, they all seemed to be resent us being there, and I don't blame them. I suppose you always get some people who are pleasant. You could even then, yes. We used to go out into Nicosia when we were off duty, and we didn't carry weapons, did we? Did we? No, perhaps we did carry weapons, but we went in civilian clothes to restaurants, and we had good meals. I think we took care, yes, we were armed, and we took care to keep our eyes open. But it wasn't 100% animosity at all.
Was it possible to make Cypriot friends?
It might have been, but I didn't. We were in a camp, away from any Cypriots. By and large, I suppose on reflection, although it's one of the places I've liked most to be in, I suppose at that time I had less contact with the locals than almost anywhere else I've ever been. I hadn't really thought about that before, but I think that's the case, probably. Probably because I don't speak Greek.
How long do you think you might have been there?
I was there, I suppose, 9 months, 9 or 10 months, when...
That's 56, 57?
Yes, it's 56. It's when the Suez thing blew up. And those of the Paget regiment who were in Cyprus, and we weren't all there at that time, were flown back home very quickly in order to... Because we'd been in Cyprus 9 months then, and we hadn't done any parachuting at all during that time. And they now realised they might want some parachutists to go into port side. So we were all flown home to be trained up, ready to go and go back out to Cyprus again and jump into port side. At that time, my second child was imminent. And so it was deemed that I would not go back to Cyprus with them when they went, which I was very sad about. So I was left as OC rear party in Aldershot, while they all flew back out to Cyprus to carry on their training. In fact, I got out to Cyprus before November the 5th, when they all jumped into port side. My daughter was born, my second daughter was born, there was no problem. And, I know, my wife was being evicted, that's right, because we'd got a hiring and she'd got to get out. So I was left behind to find a house for my wife, which I did, and moved her in this state of pregnancy. When that was done, I was able to get out of being OC rear party and rush back out to Cyprus again, hoping to join them in the jump over port side. But I failed to do that. They wouldn't let me go. I said, you haven't done the training. Why should you have all the fun? However, when I went out to the Nicosia airport on the night they took off to see them off, the last thing it looked like to them, or to me, was fun. They were looking extremely grim and drawn. Obviously, first active service jump any of them had ever done, or most of them had ever done, and even their very experienced ones were looking a bit drawn. Anyway, I managed to talk to Colonel Paul Crook, as he then was, and I said, I'm coming out, Colonel, as soon as I can get there. He said,